What's the date? 25th. Hi, welcome everyone. Today is May 25th, 2017. This is the Human Services and Housing Committee. We have only a few members here, but everything is being recorded, and my members have guaranteed to me that they're going to go back and watch this. It's a very important issue. There's a legislative breakfast going on, and then we've got two members who are testifying in Judiciary Committee right now for another bill who will be coming back. So they will be coming back hopefully by about 8:20, 8:25. And then there's a number of members, five, who are coming back later, but they're at the legislative breakfast. So this gets to be the really busy time of year where people are in different directions, but I know that they are intending to go back and watch this. I do want to say, in terms of the 2007, I know that this bill came about because we are way behind in the number of units that we need, and we're really struggling to figure out how do we do that. We have very little money from the state that can go into supporting affordable housing, and we really have to rely on the private market. So we really are taking a very strong look at how can we help the private market be efficient and get the permits that we need. And yet it's very important. Preservation is also very important. I know that's something that people have written to us a lot about, and we do have a lot of bills, House Bill 2002, that really aim at trying to make that system of preserving affordable housing more efficient as well. So that's a very big effort in 2002. There's another bill that we have that is asking for grants to nonprofit organizations that would give that out to homeowners that could make repairs and things like that. We saw a lot of displacement in, for instance, on Williams and Vancouver. That's been pointed out a lot, where there's been displacement of people in affordable homes, often because they can't afford to make the repairs. And then it's very tempting to have developers come in, buy up those homes. And unfortunately, in those multifamily units, most of them were luxury homes that we saw built over the last few years. So we've been taking a number of efforts to really look at how do we provide the kind of housing we need, how do we make sure that that we have affordable units, and preservation is as important as the creation of new housing. So these are all hard issues. We had a first chamber deadline of April 18th, and House Bill 2007 went through some revisions shortly before the deadline. This is in part because housing got flooded with a lot of different bills. Many members from both sides of the aisle understand how crucial this is in their communities around the state. So we had a number of bills, and lots of different groups were working as hard as they could to get ideas, bring stakeholders around the table, and present amendments to bills. So 2007 was passed out of our committee, I think on April 18th, right, close to the deadline. At the time, there was no opposition because people really hadn't seen the amendment that had just been released. The bill then, because of the deadline, went to Ways and Means, which is where it is now. Because it's in Ways and Means, our committee cannot take any actions on that bill. We also, and I only learned this recently, cannot even accept testimony and put it on OLIS. So any testimony that is sent, what I encourage people to do who are passionate about this bill, many people are, is to make sure that you e-subscribe to the bill, 2007, and that way the minute it gets posted for a hearing, if and when it gets posted for a hearing in Ways and Means, you will have the opportunity to send your testimony that gets put up on OLIS. In the meantime, that shouldn't stop you from emailing members of this committee, members of Ways and Means, about your feelings. But the opportunity for public testimony will happen when the bill actually gets a hearing. That's just the protocol. I thought, because we were doing an informational hearing, that we would have the opportunity to put public input on OLIS, and I was wrong. I've never done a public hearing on a bill in my committee that's no longer in my committee. So for anyone that I said, feel free to send it in. We'll put it on OLIS. I'm sorry for my own confusion. Been here 5.5 years and didn't realize that OLIS was not open to testimony for a bill that's not in my committee. But I think that having this hearing is very important. We've invited people who have different feelings about the bill. It's going through many amendments. No amendments can be acted upon until there's actually a hearing in the committee, and so the next committee is in Ways and Means. So there's no action that will be taken. I think that you'll see that OLS, the amendment is not on the regular 2007.
Correct. Yes. So if you want to see the amendment, you have to click on the meeting for today. So it's associated with our meeting. It's not associated with the bill.
Okay. So the way to get to that for anyone here or anyone who may be watching this now or later is you go to OLIS, which is OLIS.leg.state.or.us, and then you click on committees, and then from there you click on the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And then from there, at the bottom, you click on the agenda 525. And when you open the agenda for that day, at the top, you'll see agenda, meeting materials, and recording log. So if you're at home listening, there's also a little video camera where you can watch live content. Later, you can go back and watch recorded content. But under meeting materials, if you click on meeting materials, you will see the materials, the dash 4 itself, I believe. Yes, mm-hmm. The dash 4 itself is the second meeting material. Mm-hmm. And so you'll see what are some of the things being considered as people give us feedback. And just know that we are doing this because we're open to feedback, and we're going to continue looking at the bill. So I'm going to start off very briefly with Taylor Smiley Wolf, Representative and Speaker Kotek is at that legislative breakfast, but will come toward the end of the meeting. But I thought it was probably important to have her staff, Taylor Smiley Wolf, just very briefly run down what you can find on OLIS under the meeting materials for today, just so we know what the latest version is that we're talking about, and then we'll start with our panels.
Lovely. Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. Thank you so much for having me here this morning. So did you want me to just run through
the materials or what's in the amendment? This, which is
great,
on OLIS, a summary of what 2007 with the proposed dash 4 amendments, which is the latest round.
Absolutely. So this is posted on OLIS. The summary of 2004A includes the dash 4 amendments, and I'll go through by topic. Mm-hmm. So the first is permitting timelines. The bill changes the 120-day requirement that local jurisdictions have to make a decision on an application to 100 days for affordable housing. Affordable housing is defined as housing that has 50% of its units affordable to families making 60% of AMI or below. And one of the other requirements is that there has to be an affordability covenant of at least 60 years to qualify to be permitted on a fast track. So this does not allow local jurisdictions to delay the permitting timeline for non-qualifying applications or market rate or affordable housing that doesn't meet this definition. So on the clear and objective permitting standards portion of the bill, current state law mandates that local jurisdictions have to have a clear and objective path for applications for needed housing. So this bill changes the definition of needed housing to include all housing and also affordable housing. And it also says that if a developer chooses to go down a clear and objective path for permitting and they meet all of the clear and objective criteria, that the local jurisdiction has to approve the application. What this bill does not do is eliminate the discretionary pathway that developers can choose to take. That path is not mandated, but it is allowed to be the only path in some areas, so central city, regional centers, and historic places. And some local jurisdictions will choose to have a discretionary path in addition to their clear and objective. So that path stays the same. A developer can still choose to go down either one, but if they go down the clear and objective path, then their permit must be approved if it meets all of the criteria of the path. On the historic designation, we've made some significant amendments to this section. Initially, the intent of this language was to decouple the National Historic Designation process designation from the automatic application of local land use protections. Since hearing feedback about concerns related to this section, we have amended it to create some exceptions around when that automatic application of land use regulations occurs. And the four exceptions include when A home is being demolished to be replaced with a home that's affordable to families making 120% of AMI or below. When a home is being replaced with housing that is more dense and that includes more families. So in the bill, it currently says a single-family home being replaced by a duplex or triplex, but we're open to thinking about how that language better encompasses a single-family being replaced with greater density. The third is that the development only includes exterior modifications that are aesthetic in nature, because we don't believe that that fits the definition of a demolition. So the local jurisdiction would have to make a decision to apply additional protections related to aesthetic review at the local level. And then also, if a development or if the demolition only includes accessory structures like a garage, it doesn't qualify for automatic demolition review. So to be clear, these exceptions do not prevent the local jurisdiction from choosing to apply additional protections at the local level if they would like to either the exception areas or to single-family homes that are not covered in the exception areas. So they can do that. It just has to be through a local decision-making process. So this just deals with specifically the automatic application of local land use regulations when a neighborhood gets designated as a historic place. And this is only the case for districts that get designated on or after the effective date of the bill. So it does not apply to existing districts that have a National Historic Designation. I want to be very clear about that. So on the back side of the page, on density and infill, the bill requires that cities and counties may not prohibit the development of ADUs and duplexes in zones that are zoned for single family. It does allow local jurisdictions to regulate the development of those types of housing. They just are not allowed to outright prohibit it, and the regulations can't have the effect of discouraging that that type of development in single-family zones. Let's see. And we've exempted small jurisdictions from this requirement. The Sections 8 and 9 of the bill allow land that is owned by religious organizations to be developed for affordable housing. And again, we define affordable housing here as 50% of the units must be affordable at 60% of AMI for at least 60 years. And the underlying zoning does apply. So if a religious organization chooses to have the land developed for affordable housing, the surrounding zoning of that area would apply. So if it's a single-family zone, you would only be allowed to develop single-family affordable homes on the land. And then finally, the bill adds some data collection requirements for local governments who already submit data to the Department of Land Conservation and Development regarding permit applications. So it adds some additional reporting requirements, including the number of affordable units that they get in application, and then similarly the density that is applied for versus the density that they approve. And I think I did miss one thing at the beginning around another directive for DLCD. So the bill also directs DLCD to study the permitting timelines by looking at a sample of applications and a sample of sort of representative jurisdictions around the state to get a sense of what the barriers are to shortening that timeline and to hopefully make some recommendations about how we can make that shorter. So that might have been longer than you had hoped for, but wow. Let me know if you have any questions. It does a lot.
Yeah, that's great. Any questions now? Okay.
Fabulous.
Thank you so much. All right. So our first panel is Anyale Halowa, Phil Bile, Sean Hubert, and Eli Spivak.
Seats there. Mm-hmm. So we've only got three seats there.
You can pull up a chair.
Pull up a chair.
Oh. We'll bring up another chair.
Oh, they're attached.
Yeah.
Would like to start?
I guess I'll start. Good morning. My name is Sean Hubert. I'm the Chief Housing Officer for Central City Concern, a Portland nonprofit working to end homelessness through coordinated interventions including housing, healthcare, recovery, and employment services. Most of us in this room are well acquainted with the state of housing in Oregon. Oregon's state economist estimates that across the state more than 100,000 units would need to be built this year to make up for the deficit of the past 10. That's six times the number of housing units that were built in 2016. Obviously, we need to look at new ways of promoting housing for Oregonians, and this bill, while not perfect, is a step in the right direction. I want to focus my remarks today on three specific issues addressed in this bill: density, permitting timelines, and objective standards. I'll start with density. given the state of housing in Oregon, we need to look at ways to increase density. And this bill goes after a few areas of low-hanging fruit: ADUs, duplexes, and infill on church-owned property. My remarks will mostly focus on ADUs, but are largely relevant to duplexes as well. ADUs have been called gentle density, invisible density, and distributed housing. In the past, they were known as in-law units. No matter the name, they have proven to be an effective, low-impact way of increasing land utilization, providing affordable housing options, supporting families as they grow and as their housing needs change, as well as providing a source of income and asset generation for homeowners. As infill development, they make efficient and green use of existing infrastructure and help increase densities to levels at which transit becomes viable, yet with lower cost and quicker permitting processes than larger multifamily apartments. A study out of Berkeley found that 60% of ADUs are used for permanent housing and 58% are below market rate. And those numbers are from a very tight rental market. In most markets, I would expect both the permanent housing and affordability rates to be much higher. Another benefit is that oftentimes these units are the only rental housing available in well-situated and well-resourced single-family neighborhoods, making it possible for people from all walks of life to live in high-opportunity areas. Since Portland started looking at ADU zoning and incentive improvements, we've seen about 2,000 ADUs placed into service, with most of those coming online over the past 2 years. That's a meaningful number of affordable units when viewed against similar production by city and state-funded affordable housing projects, almost equal. But we need to do more than just require that jurisdictions allow for ADU development. Studies have shown that unfamiliarity with zoning, permitting, and financing are psychological deterrents that keep homeowners from pursuing ADUs. The city of Santa Cruz is often cited as a model due to its multi-pronged approach to encouraging ADU construction via an ADU manual, loan fund, fee waivers, and community workshops. We need this kind of effort on a larger scale here in Oregon, and I hope that future state efforts can look at ways of advancing this. We might even find a cost-effective way to incentivize homeowners to build regulated, affordable ADUs. Regarding permitting timelines and objective standards, we all know that time is money, and developers with teams of architects, engineers, consultants, and contractors, the money adds up pretty quickly. The move supported by this bill of tightening permitting timelines for affordable housing from 120 to 100 days is both very achievable and helpful. The more significant added cost, however, comes more from objective building standards or the lack thereof than from permitting timelines. And on this point, we do need to have a deeper conversation, as affordable housing for all Oregonians is as critical an issue as any. And there are real dynamic tensions at play. On one hand, subjective design review does support overall community aesthetics and livability. On the other hand, it meaningfully adds to cost, particularly for affordable housing. CCC has three active development projects right now. Two are under objective community design guidelines, and one has had to go through a subjective design review process. While it is always challenging to compare the costs of different projects, we estimate that, adjusted for things like owner-driven construction variations and unit size differences, the costs have been about $25,000 per door higher for the design review project, which equates to about $3 million in added costs on that project. But there's more at stake here than just dollars. When public funders are weighing competitive funding applications partially on the cost per unit, that makes developments in design overlays, which are often in the highest opportunity areas with the best access to transit and other amenities, less competitive with projects in lower opportunity areas. And that's a real equity issue, and one we need to wrestle with further as a state. I would encourage you to follow up with the Department of Land Conservation and Development as they study this issue as instructed in this bill, to include a closer look at permitting standards alongside their look at permitting timelines. In closing, I believe this bill is a meaningful step forward for the state on these issues, although more work remains to be done. I'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
We'll hold questions off to the end.
Yeah. I was going to use the.
Let me just. Do you want to switch things here? Are you good?
I'll just make this big.
I don't have a prepared statement, so if I'm over on time, please tell me. Okay. My name is Anyalai Halova, and I'm a partner with a developer called Project. We consider ourselves a values-oriented development company, and we're located in Portland, Oregon. I submitted some information that I hope that on your spare time that you'll get a chance to read with regard to the project that I'm talking about. The project was in Corvallis, and it was called Harrison Apartments at the time. And this is a really good case study with regard to how public participation and ideas behind historic preservation and other misunderstandings on zoning can influence a process of a project and effectively reduce density in a core location. And I ended up writing a paper on this exact topic that was presented at the International Academy Academic Association of Planning Law and Property Rights in 2013. So it's very, there's a lot of detail that I would hope that you'd read. But basically, this was a project that was located in an R20 high density area in Corvallis. And it was in the planned development overlay, which basically allowed it to be open to public comment, regardless if we were following clear and objective standards on that site. We had many meetings with the neighborhood. It changed a lot of things as a result of that, but we met our height, our lot coverage, our density, our parking went above and beyond in that regard. Due to public pressure, mainly talking about things like parking and traffic, but in the end of the day, really it was about the fact that we were building a multifamily housing building adjacent to a single-family neighborhood, that a lot of the people in the adjacent historic neighborhood were opposed to this project, even though it did not exist within those historic boundaries. This led to a denial of the project at Planning Commission, following a lot of the sentiments of the neighborhood rather than looking at the clear and objective standards with regard to that. Because we didn't want to go through a protracted period, which we believe would have ended at LUBA in the state, we decided that we would change our plans almost completely to get through the process easier. We probably ended up spending over $100,000 worth in legal fees. And effectively, the outcome was that the unit count was reduced by 24%, the loss of 22 units in the process. At the end of the day, the cost that we needed to charge for those units was calculated at 3% more than what we had planned to do. And you can see in this PowerPoint the original proposal and kind of how it went to the next proposal at the end. And what was really unfortunate about it is that some of the things that we had to do to get the project to be a less dense project included going against some of the pedestrian-oriented design standards that the community said and went against a lot of the comprehensive plan and visioning documents that the community said they wanted. And so, in effect, this reduced the needed high-density housing in Corvallis and promoted greenfield development because housing's not provided in the core. There were some annexations being done at the same time that were basically allowed, but this height, you know, more density in the core was not, which increases dependence on vehicles and increases traffic with the inclusion of more parking than was required, and also undermines the kind of placemaking goals and values of the community. And at the end of the day, really compromise clear and objective standards for the ability of a developer to come into a community and understand what they can build. So with regard to this bill, I am supportive of religious places being allowed to have affordable housing. We talked to a lot of churches that want to contribute toward this need. ADUs and duplexes would be smart and elegant solution to densifying single-family homes and neighborhoods. And obviously, reducing the timeline for affordable housing is super important to that process. I think my only concern on the bill would be with regard to the idea of design review. I think that design review is a very important part of our process, especially in the city of Portland and as it expands across the state, and with regard to placemaking and raising the bar for what communities should have. I want to make sure I agree with what people say with regard to design review shouldn't limit your understanding of your height and your density on a site, but I do believe that design review should have the ability to shape kind of the massing of the building through that process. because I think that's important. And so I think in general, without clear and objective standards, it allows NIMBY behavior to hijack the process, which has an effect on the public good, not only for the projects that need to happen, but also for the future affordability and inclusive nature that we want in our cities.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Phil Beil. I'm a principal architect with GBD Architects in Portland. Thanks for having the chance to come down here and talk to you about this very important bill. Over my 40 years of practice, I've had the good fortune of working on virtually hundreds of commercial and multifamily projects, primarily in the downtown core area of Portland, almost all of which involve Portland's design review process. I'm a firm believer and supporter of that process and the quality that it's provided for us. I believe where I can add some value to this hearing is a discussion about the importance of retaining the right to the mapped height and density that's written into the amendments as they're currently prescribed, because it's important on housing yield. The bill contains provisions that would prohibit the city from reducing the allowed height and density of a housing project through the application of discretionary design guidelines. This element of the bill is really critical to meeting the planned growth for as needed for our cities, and let me hopefully explain that a little bit. Through a legislative planning process, which is quite exhausted, the City of Portland, for example, has mapped each and every property in the Central City Plan District with permitted height and densities. Each height and density allowance is a result of a multitude of factors, including proximity to transit, view corridors, open spaces, density objectives, growth goals, and many, many more. The mapped height and the density work together to create the allowed building envelope that we use as architects to design each and every project. Density is expressed in the amount of floor area in relation to the amount of site area. It's commonly called FAR, floor area ratio. So an example of that, if you have a 100 by 100 foot site, which is a very typical sort of building site in downtown Portland, a quarter block, that allows you a 10,000 square foot site area. A 4-to-1 FAR would allow you to build 40,000 square feet of building on that site. When you're building multifamily housing projects, a 10,000 square foot floor plate is not a very efficient floor plate to build. So we need to put that same amount of floor area into a taller mass, which is typically allowed and made provisions for in the code. A site like that might have a height limitation of about 65 feet, for example. So I could do six floors at 7 or 8,000 square feet versus four floors at 10,000 square feet. So a really important thing from a design standpoint. Your density and height allowances establish the economical fundamentals for the site. Certainly on height and density allow you to set property values, analyze performance for the development of the site, educate investors on the unit yields for the site, among many, many other things, some of which Anule has already spoken to in terms of a developer's preliminary look at whether or not to build on a site. But if that allowed height and density is not honored in the design review process, a lot of needed housing may be lost and can be at risk. A good example of that with a project that's under construction today is a high-rise commercial project that we're doing that has an attendant site that has an affordable housing project on it. We used the bonus floor area for that high-rise building to fill a 300-foot height limitation that's outright allowed on the site. The site happens to be adjoining a couple of historic buildings. It also adjoins a public open space, thereby casting shadows on those spaces. It also blocks views from a condominium that's a few blocks away towards Mount Hood. All things that would make it right for somebody to object and perhaps have a discretionary ruling come back from Design Commission to say reduce that height. What would we have lost if we had not done that project in that capacity? We would have lost $3 million in incremental tax income or property tax value on each and every year that the project produces. We would have lost the space for 1,100 professional jobs to be added to the central city. More importantly, we would have lost the affordable housing piece, which was made possible by that economy of scale, which added 76 affordable housing units to the inventory right downtown where we need it most. So it can be very impactful. Not only does the map density and height allowance create the certainty needed to set property value and invest in a housing project, but the way the city defines density also plays an enormous role in whether affordable housing projects will be constructed. City regulates density by base FAR and bonus FAR. As an example, a site could have a base FAR of 6 to 1 but earn a bonus of 3 to 1 if the project meets certain public objectives. One of those public objectives, of course, is now inclusionary housing or affordable housing. If you have a site in the central city and you build 20 units or more, you're required now to build affordable housing. But one of the offsets to that requirement is that you are entitled to a bonus of 3 to 1. That FAR bonus is mandatory and encourages the production of affordable housing in exchange for extra density. I can assure you that we wouldn't see any additional multifamily housing projects given these new criteria come onto the market if they don't have the bonus of 3 to 1 allowed by that provision. And so the discretion to take it away would thereby eliminate the ability to build additional affordable housing. The House bill ensures that the earned density for affordable housing can't in turn be taken away through a discretionary design review process. That's important, as without the bonus, the affordable housing simply wouldn't be built. And this is really the central reason why the current language in House Bill 2007 that prohibits the city from reducing allowed heights and densities through discretionary design guidelines is so important. Some may argue that prohibiting reduction in allowed density and height weakens design review, but as a champion of good design and design review, I don't believe that's going to be the case. The design review guidelines that we are all beholden to have no current language that directly addresses height or density. Instead, the guidelines address the quality of materials, permanence, qualities of the pedestrian experience, and the like. Those guidelines will continue to be applied in design review in a manner that will continue to protect the desired design environment, both for affordable and market rate housing, as the House bill preserves that opportunity. I should underscore this in point that it's really a false choice to pit quality design against density. In Portland's Central City, we need both, and the House Bill 2007 supports both. The design review process in Portland has continuously evolved over its 35-year history. Significant efforts happen to be underway as we speak that address its relevance and capacity to respond to a massive influx of projects. My view is that design review has been hugely impactful in helping to create the qualities of the urban environment we enjoy in the central city today, and House Bill 2007 will help preserve that. I urge you to support House Bill 2007, including language that protects properties mapped in allowable height and density and does not allow the reduction of that density, height, and housing yield through design review. Thanks very much, and happy to answer questions when you're done.
Thank you. Thank you.
My name is Eli Spivak. Thanks for inviting me to present. And I'm a developer, general contractor in Northeast Portland. I've also done some research for the state of Oregon on a really wonkily named report, Character Compatible Space Efficient Housing Options for Single Dwelling Neighborhoods. And want to share some images here and some testimony as well. In many Oregon neighborhoods, the normal house getting built is a large single-family house, very different from the homes that were built before World War II. Households are getting smaller, though. The average house size from 1950 to 2008 has grown from 983 square feet to 2,500 square feet. At the same time, average family size has dropped from 3.8 to 2.6. So we suddenly have over three times as much space. We're getting much larger, I guess. And you can see, at this point, I'm just clicking through the decades in the bottom left corner there, showing 1980, 1990, 2000. And what you're seeing as the green area gets smaller, that's the number of three-plus person households. So at this point, almost two-thirds of households are one- and two-person households, quite a mismatch for the housing types we're building. So in this study, which I think is relevant to this bill because three-quarters of it are addressed in it in one way or the other, is to look at corner duplexes, internal home conversions, accessory dwelling units, and cottage clusters as ways to provide space-efficient housing within existing neighborhoods that fit in well with the neighborhood and provide smaller homes that are better demographic match and are less expensive to live in, so you can sprinkle affordability into neighborhoods and also have a population density so eventually those neighborhoods can support walkable neighborhoods. So just to get a few images on the table, these are some corner duplexes. In this, the one on the bottom right corner is from Salem. The one in the upper, and the others are from Portland. Those are the two cities that actually provide a density bonus for doing a duplex. Portland lets you double your density on the corners. Salem gives you a smaller density bonus. Elsewhere in the state, nothing right now. But both these cities have already done what this bill is asking for. And I think that extending that to other parts of the state would be helpful. Accessory dwelling units, we see. The first upper left corner, that's where Thomas Jefferson lived with his family before they moved into Monticello while they were building it. And, of course, Fonz lived in an ADU over the garage. We've got all sorts of ADUs, permutations can be built. You can have a detached accessory dwelling unit, a whole different structure. You can have a, on the bottom right, that's from Eugene, an addition to an existing house, looks just like a house. A basement conversion, incredibly discreet, tucked into old neighborhoods. The one in the middle there is a detached ADU sold separately as a condominium to hit a price point in the 200s in a city of Portland where that's awfully hard to find. I've done some of those before, hitting a lower price point than that. Other examples, the upper right corner is replacing a garage on Hawthorne in Portland, very expensive neighborhood. Now someone can live there, a mother-in-law of the person who owns the property. Detached accessory dwellings, if you have a in the bottom left corner, that's in Portland also. A new construction where someone just tucked in an accessory dwelling unit upstairs that serves as an affordable rental in an otherwise very gentrifying neighborhood of Cully. The bottom right, I think that's from Eugene, that's where the existing house was very small. And by reclassifying the existing house as an accessory dwelling unit, they were able to build an additional house on the site without taking down the existing house, notably. ADUs are incredibly flexible for different stages of life. So a lot of times I hear from people who are seniors who want to continue living in their own neighborhood, but there's nowhere they can live without carting around that 2,000 square foot house they raised their family in. What they want to do is build an ADU in the backyard, live in that, rent out the main house, or have their extended family move in. Also for younger families who are priced out of neighborhoods, for teachers who otherwise can't live in the same neighborhood where their school is, where they work, this provides an option, and they're discrete by definition. ADUs have, although typically they're rented at kind of market rents, as you see that bell curve on the left side, you see that almost 20% of them are rented out for nothing or a tiny amount. They're providing a certain legacy of affordable housing as people use them as safety nets for loved ones or family who otherwise would be have to rent somewhere else and compete in the rental market. Another strategy that is supported by this proposal is to make it easier to internally divide existing homes. That's one way to keep them. And these are all examples of homes that were internally converted. A larger home from years ago that is no longer got a family that big, and it can become affordable housing. And in many neighborhoods in the state, as we had huge population growth during World War II, the last time we had a real growth crisis here, for the shipbuilding industry, countless homes were internally divided, and those homes grandfathered in, even though the zoning right now might not allow it, provide a legacy of affordable housing that is still affordable today. I'm not going to skip over cottage clusters because that's not really part of this bill, although I love them. And talk about missing middle housing. This is an idea that what's being built nowadays are those really large single-family homes I showed at the beginning and 4-over-1 apartments. And you're not seeing much construction in the range in between. Townhomes, cottage clusters, duplexes, accessory dwellings. And that's a really inexpensive housing type. It's wood frame, two-story construction, single-family dwelling. And it's what we need more of in our neighborhoods. So trying to open up the door to those options is something this bill addresses at the low end of the spectrum. So I'll end with a few slides here. Portland zoning map here, if you see the yellow area, that's the part of our city that is currently zoned single family. And if you look at what's actually built in some of those closer in areas, you'll see a whole smattering of housing types, courtyard plexes, duplexes, quads, all sorts of things, because those were built before these rules were in effect. As we look to further out areas of the city where we're still building out neighborhoods, we unfortunately are building under the current rules. And that means we're getting a monocrop of large homes that may doom those neighborhoods to never have the population density it takes to support walkable environments. So I thought I'd look at some other cities too. There's Bend. Conveniently, the same color yellow means single family. And you can see that, I don't know the percentage, but a huge percentage of the land area is single family. Here's our Salem, where we are right now. Once again, same color scheme. And most of the land area in Salem appears to be single family zoning. So the question is all this area going to be just a lot of single large homes, or are we going to have more choices? So I'm supportive of this bill because it provides more choices. And lastly, here's Le Grand, a little bit further out. This time, blue is like a 5,000 square foot lot. Once again, most of the land area seems to be zoned for single-family homes. Now, I love single-family homes. I live in one, and I think that we should continue to support that with this legislation. But we really need to have places within our neighborhoods where you can have smaller, more affordable housing options discreetly sprinkled in. That's what this bill would do. I would say Oregon's actually a little bit behind the times on this. California required every city to allow accessory dwelling units, I think a decade ago. And they found that local jurisdictions sometimes just, I won't use the finger expression, told the state to get out of their business and wrote the codes in such a way that you couldn't actually use them. Last September, they updated their requirement in California with some rules saying you have to allow accessory dwelling units and you cannot require an extra parking space. You cannot do some various poison pills that were being put into state local laws. I hope we don't have to go that way in Oregon. We might not need to. Most cities in Oregon already allow accessory dwellings. Not very many allow duplexes in these zones. So I think that we already have a head start in terms of local adoption, but as a statewide requirement, both Washington and California already require accessory dwelling units to be allowed. They don't have – California just put teeth into theirs. I hope we don't have to put teeth into ours to make it happen, but I'm optimistic that this is the first step in that process.
Okay. I'm going to call up the next panel because I want to make sure that we – oh, yeah. Taylor wanted to mention one thing she forgot, so while I hope that you can stick around in case there's questions at the end, but I'm designating half an hour max for each panel because I want to make sure to get to everyone. So if there are questions and you're in the audience, we might call you back up at the end. Thank you. So Taylor skipped one thing. Come on up and tell us quickly.
Hello. Again, for the record, my name is Taylor Smiley-Wolf on behalf of Speaker Kotek. I forgot something in my summary that Phil covered very well, but the bill also requires a developer or allows developers to build to the density that's authorized in the local zoning code. So Phil explained that in his testimony, but I just wanted to come up and summarize that piece that I missed in the beginning summary. So density bonuses and structures that have different levels of authorization are still maintained under the bill, but if a developer meets the criteria of the zone that's authorized under a particular section of their code, then they are entitled to the maximum density and height in that portion.
And it says unless for a health, safety,
habitability, yeah.
Habitability reason or to comply with protection measures under statewide planning goals.
Yes, and that does include preservation of historic resources.
Thank you. All right, next panel. We have Peggy Moretti, George Kramer, Michael Mahaffey. And I know George has to be somewhere by 9:30. So whatever order you would like, but I'm aware of that.
Come on.
Sure. Good morning, Chair. Thank you for adjusting this so that I can participate. By way of introduction, my name is George Kramer. I live in Ashland, Oregon. I have 30 years' experience as a professional preservation consultant. I work all over the Pacific Northwest. Frankly, I mostly work with commercial properties because there's too much drama in residential. But I, in the early part of my career, have listed half a dozen residential historic districts with probably 4,000 or 5,000 properties in them total. I've spent a certain amount of time looking at neighborhoods, holding a clipboard, and trying to figure out what makes them tick. I feel, sitting here and listening to the testimony of the first panel and reading this bill, that I ought to say one of these things is not like the other. I am not from Portland. We have very different issues in the southern part of the state. We have a housing crisis in Ashland. There's no doubt about it. And I applaud this committee for the intent of 2007. We do need to do something. Our housing crisis is unlike the metro area in that we have huge conversions to Airbnbs. We have huge conversions from equity immigrants from California and all over the country that want to come and live in our adorable little community. And all of that has driven what formerly were very affordable, very low-cost prices and rentals out of reach. I live in a town where 70% of the public employees live in another city because they can't afford to live in Ashland. We have school teachers that don't live in Ashland because they can't afford to. I also am the board president of the Ashland Emergency Food Bank, and I know that public employees are so stretched for their housing that they come in to get food from us monthly. So, congratulations on your efforts. There are a lot of things that I like about this bill. There are a lot of things that I like about the effort to increase density. There's a lot of things that I like from the first panel that I entirely agree with. If transforming a bill whose goal was affordable housing into something of an attack on historic preservation, historic districts, wasn't, if the historic districts weren't part of this bill and the underlying zoning was remained the same and all you're trying to do was add ADUs and encourage religious institutions to have an easier time getting approval to build to the zoning, I wouldn't be here. I think it is critical that if you are going to increase density in historic areas, that there be design review to assure that that is compatible, that that new construction is compatible. We have very little, if you look at the total residential development of Oregon in historic districts, it's like 4 or 5% of all property, all residential property located in historic districts. These are districts that have been set aside through an existing public process by the community because they like their character and they want to keep it. Now, I can say that, and frankly, especially with the improvements that have been made, the proposed amendments, there are things about this bill that I will talk about in a minute that I don't like. But this is not going to have a huge impact on the character of the historic districts in my part of the world, simply because in my part of the world, most of the historic districts were zoned R2 originally, because when cities adopted Senate Bill 100, they looked at the old funky rundown parts of the community and thought, well, that's a great place for redevelopment. Let's put the multifamily there. And here we are 40 or 50 years later, and those are all the cool old historic houses, walkable close to downtown that everybody wants to live in. And so what this bill is proposing, even to its total build out, you can't build but a 40, 35 foot tall building in the areas of southern Oregon, at least, that are designated historic. Most of the other surrounding houses are one or two stories tall. It's not going to make that big of a difference. It's not going to achieve the goals that you're after either, because the issues in the rest of the world are not design review. They are the underlying zoning. They're off-street parking, they're side yard setbacks, they're solar access. They're all of those kinds of things. The neighbors don't really, there's not a neighborhood pushback like there was in Corvallis. There's just no economic incentive to tear down a single family dwelling and build four or five, even apartments, even market rate apartments. We can't even get that in our two zones. I have been talking to my city council about we should prohibit people in an R2 zone in Ashland, in the Ashland Historic Districts, from building R1. If a house burns or is destroyed and you want to rebuild, you shouldn't be able to build a bigger single-family residence. You should build a multifamily residence. I don't have a problem with that from as a historic preservation person. What I don't understand moving forward in time and what I don't like about this bill is for newly designated districts, I don't understand why you would exclude developments that include only exterior modifications that are aesthetic in nature from review. In a historic district, that's what we regulate, is exterior modifications. Everything is the aesthetic. And again, I don't think that it is impossible, and I think you've even seen some examples this morning, of building compatible, affordable dwellings in historic districts. I have issues with 120% of median income. If we are going to sacrifice historic homes, small single-family residences, in a goal of increasing density, and I don't necessarily have a problem with that, I think that the goal should be to assure that those are affordable. I love the 60-year covenant We have affordable housing that results from density bonuses in my community that I usually refer to as a good deal for the developer's cousin. Because the first time they are sold, they are affordable. A year later, they're back at market rate. A 60-year covenant would help that. I think, though, that you really need to change this bill to include clear and specific language about affordability as its goal and avoid the muddling of it with needed housing. That's a Portland issue, in my opinion. I think that there are incentives that you can provide. I know the state doesn't have any money, but there should be for affordable development in all zones things like density bonuses, things like reduced side yard setbacks, things like reduced off-street parking. You can still have floor area ratios, FARs, and height limits. And if you modify those in historic districts, in my districts, they're already consistent. Apparently, what I'm understanding is Portland has historic districts that have 150-foot allowable heights. I could see where that's something of a problem. I'll tell you one story and then I'll quit. In Ashland, we have, as I say, a very different housing crisis. 10 years ago, we had a situation where very wealthy individuals were coming in and buying two or three houses, tearing them down, consolidating the lots, and building 10 and 15,000 square foot houses in our historic core. We passed what was called, is generally called, the maximum house size ordinance. At that time, the average single family dwelling in America was 2,400 square feet. We added 20% to that. It's about 3,200 square feet is the maximum house size. You can buy an entire city block and combine it, but you can only build a 3,200 square foot house in the historic core. The realtors were concerned. City Council passed it unanimously, and the reason they did, which is the model I want you to consider when we talk about historic districts for Bill 2007, the reason the Ashland City Council supported the maximum house size ordinance was because it only applied in the historic designated areas. They recognized that there was a different set of rules, a different scale, and a different community value in those areas, and that if you needed to build a 10,000 square foot house, you got the whole rest of town to do it in. Historic districts are 5% of Oregon. Less than that, I assume, I'm told by Peggy in Portland. Don't throw away what we have all worked as Oregonians to protect in our heritage, in our historic character, in the drive to increase density. You got the whole rest of the town, the whole rest of Portland to do that. And finally, remember that we're different than you guys. Everybody's testifying about Portland. Don't pass a bill that affects the rest of the state negatively. Thank you.
Thank you. And I appreciate you coming from so far. And we do have Ben coming up as well. But
hi. I'm Peggy Moretti. Thank you for inviting me. I'm the executive director of Restore Oregon, a statewide nonprofit organization whose mission is to preserve, reuse, and pass forward the historic places that make our communities livable and sustainable. We are very concerned that House Bill 2007 will do far more harm than good to both Oregon's historic districts and to the overall livability of cities and neighborhoods. It's clear this bill started out with very good intentions. We really do need to create a lot more affordable housing and should certainly seek to remove obstacles that slow that down. The first version of this bill appeared to tackle that. But then it got hijacked by special interests and a personal vendetta. Home builders have expanded its focus to accelerate construction of all housing, as if market rate housing really needed any assistance. And Thousand Friends, forgetting who their friends are, indulged a crusade by its lobbyists to attack historic districts and weaken what few protections they have. And historic resources are under attack from all sides. And this was done in the name of increased density and housing for all. Today, House Bill 2007 has become something of a Frankenstein's monster of pieced together provisions that really don't belong. And they're unnecessarily complicated, and as I said, it's going to do more harm than good. Furthermore, for a bill that overrides local zoning and comprehensive plans, there's been entirely insufficient public engagement. The initial public hearing appears to have been consciously conducted under the radar, with directly affected constituents unaware. Now, hundreds of citizens have submitted their letters of testimony to this hearing, and they've been rejected. I have copies of them here, and I mean there are literally hundreds. And I appreciate knowing that we can resubmit those to Ways and Means, but has felt very suspect, whether it was intended or not, that the whole process has seemed very suspect. Even with the latest amendments, this bill is still based on a set of false assumptions, and it's full of potential loopholes that are going to keep some lawyers really well employed. First, House Bill 2007 assumes that the way to create more affordability is to build, baby, build. This trickle-down theory doesn't work in economics, and it doesn't work in affordable housing. I know of no examples where it has, in fact, worked, and all you have to do is just look a little further south to the San Francisco Bay Area, where there's been unfettered development, and the exact opposite of affordability has occurred. And this bill does nothing to incentivize those adorable, charming ADUs that Eli was just showing us photos of. It'd be great if that's what people chose to build. But it assumes that allowing duplexes virtually everywhere is somehow going to magically protect the UGB and generate affordable housing. In actuality, this bill is going to incentivize and accelerate the demolition of modest-priced homes. And they'll be replaced with units, whether they're duplexes or not, that are each two and three times more expensive than that which was demolished. The bill assumes that design review is the major obstacle to housing development, but I have an awful lot of colleagues in city planning and even in testimony today that have talked about the importance and the value of design review. I think we're dealing more with costs about land and other permitting and other fees and standards that need to be addressed. It also assumes that that the standardization of clear and objective standards is going to allow us to arrive at quality and high compatibly done infill development. But in many cases, the broad generalized standards are insufficient for neighborhoods where you need much more creativity and nuanced design. And as others have mentioned, this bill assumes that historic districts, which actually, by our calculations, make up less than 3% of residential zoning, we know that for a fact to be true in the Portland area, that they're somehow the problem because these historic protections might somehow, potentially, restrict affordable housing or infill. So the bill sets aside protections against demolition of those rare resources if density is being increased, or if the historic structure is being replaced with affordable housing, but the accepted standard for affordable has been raised to 120% of median family income. So there's been like a double standard there on how we're defining affordable. In fact, there are scores of historic districts around the state that include affordable housing. And you don't have to look any further than the Erickson Fritz Apartments in Portland's Skidmore Old Town or the Merwin Hotel project, which is currently being developed in Astoria. The developer of that project, who supported the original version of this bill, has made this statement. Innovative Housing, IHI, supports the preservation of historic properties and is opposed to demolition of these properties to increase density. Historic properties are a limited resource and should be preserved. Many new construction opportunities are available on property that does not require the demolition of historic structures. As a developer of affordable housing, IHI supports the creative development of affordable housing, but not at the expense of historic properties. That statement comes from Julie Garver, who is their housing development director. If you really want to create affordable housing, one of the first things you should do is stop the demolition of existing affordable housing. But this bill actually manages to incentivize those demolitions. Restore Oregon has been tracking each and every residential demolition in Portland for a couple of years now. There were 376 in 2016. A few of those homes were, in fact, derelict, and they're no great loss. But many, most, were perfectly good, modest-priced homes and rentals. In no case we know of were they replaced with affordable housing. And I have a few slides. Hold on. Just to kind of do a quick illustration. If you look at these at the, let's see if I can click here. If you look at these illustrations, look at the sales price of that unit and then what replaced it. Mm-hmm. This is what's going on. This is just a few samples, and these were not cherry-picked, by the way. We've got a couple of examples of duplexes. Not affordable. These demolitions, all those demolitions, did not increase density in any meaningful way. Our analysis shows that for each home demoed, it was replaced by less than 1.5 new units. The vast majority of demolitions are 1-for-1. But a lot of neighborhood character and affordability has been lost, not to mention tons and tons and tons of material thrown into the landfill. House Bill 2007 needs a do-over, or at least a major overhaul. It needs to discourage demolition of existing modest-priced homes. You could allow discretionary demolition review outside of historic districts to achieve that. And it needs to emphasize ADUs and internal conversions to add density. Those generate more affordable housing units than brand-new duplexes do. Drop stipulations that prioritize maximum density over compatibility and community character, because density at all costs is bad policy. And livability does matter. Remove all references to historic districts and attempts to circumvent what few protections exist in Oregon. Historic districts are not the problem. These are rare and irreplaceable resources. They do not prohibit affordable housing or infill. And the recently enacted Goal 5 rules ensure ample public engagement. But really, most of all, this bill really should focus only, exclusively, on lowering obstacles to truly affordable housing. Affordable as in 60% of median family income. Market rate housing does not need any help. Limits on the approval timeline, clear and objective standards. We support whatever is proven to make truly affordable housing more competitive. But as it currently stands, this bill is a case study in overreach, unnecessary complexity, and bad unintended consequences. Thank you.
Good morning, and thank you for the invitation also. And as Peggy illustrates, these are certainly serious issues before us. I'm Michael Mahaffey, and I'm a consultant in sustainable urban development, and I'm currently a senior researcher at KTH University in Stockholm. I'm also a resident of Portland and president of the Goose Hollow Neighborhood Association, and I'm executive director of the Sustasis Foundation, which is an Oregon nonprofit developing tools for sustainable urban development. And I've also taught at the University of Oregon and elsewhere. Just a little more about my background because I want to set the stage. Over my career, I have served as a home builder, developer, planner, designer, and consultant, working on sustainable development policies for the city of Portland, for Metro, and for a number of other area governments. And I've also worked on projects in North America, South America, and Europe, and most recently for the United Nations on the challenges of rapid urbanization and affordability and equity and cities for all. And I wanted to preface my remarks with this background because I think what we face today is really a global challenge. The failure of many cities to work well for all their citizens, particularly as they grow rapidly. And to meet this challenge, I think we'll have to better understand what the great urbanist Jane Jacobs called the kind of problem a city is, and learn from our considerable mistakes of recent decades, especially our tendency to focus on top-down approaches that produce regrettable unintended consequences, as my colleagues have alluded to. As Jacobs pointed out, urban diversity is not only a matter of justice, it's really a question of how well our cities actually perform as engines of sustainable economic and human development. The research shows that to the extent that some populations are cut off from open access to the city and its benefits, the city will underperform economically and socially, with impacts on prosperity and quality of life and health for all the residents. So in that respect, I applaud the motivation behind this legislation, as my colleagues have. At the same time, I think we have to ask very hard questions about what the actual outcomes will be from our approaches and who will actually benefit. So in that spirit, I'd like to share with you what I think are three significant lessons from an international perspective. The lesson one is that real estate markets clearly do not follow a simple supply-demand-price formula. Building more supply does not always lower cost, not if the supply itself is more expensive than the existing supply, or if it serves to make the location more desirable relative to other places, more affordable, for example. Of course, we're not in an isolated fixed housing market here in Oregon. There's a dynamic problem of what's known as induced demand. The more affordable we make our housing, the more we attract residents from the more expensive markets of California and elsewhere. Of course, we do need to build to accommodate a growing population. There's no doubt about that. But I think it's essential to do so in places and ways that build on and do not destroy the existing assets of our cities. There are indeed many diverse places within the Portland region and other Oregon cities where gentle densification can and should occur. And Eli showed some examples of that. As we saw when I was working with Metro on development within its Centers and Corridors plan, there's a surprisingly large capacity of building sites, many existing infill sites, parking lots, and other underutilized places. The results can be popular mixed-use assets for the surrounding neighborhoods, as I think we showed at Orenco Station, if you're familiar with that project, where I was project manager. We do not need to destroy our livable heritage or force existing residents to accept major disruptions to the quality and beauty of their neighborhoods. We do need better tools to unlock and incentivize development in these other places. Following that, lesson two, I would say, is that more broadly, complicated formulas and mandates are no replacement for a careful toolkit-based approach, as I'll call it, using locally applied fine-grained tools to incentivize the kind of growth we need and to provide the kinds of protections also needed for existing residents and disadvantaged populations, and also for our heritage assets, as Peggy talked about. You're on the right track in some ways, but again, this, I think it needs a lot of work. Lesson three is that I think it's vital to work with existing residents and not against them. Over my own career in public involvement, I've seen how residents can be converted into partners to find good win-win solutions. For example, discretionary review, as you've been trying to explore, can be supplemented, not replaced, with a streamlined prescriptive path for projects to be essentially pre-approved, but only if they follow specifications developed with the neighborhood residents to assure compatibility and maintain quality. Portland and other Oregon cities are full of wonderful compatible examples of what we might call beauty in my backyard and that neighborhoods would support and could support. I know my colleagues have already pointed out the important economic and cultural value of Oregon's heritage assets, and I probably don't need to remind the colleagues of that here. And these are resources we should value and protect, surely. But may I also point out that when residents are upset over demolitions, it may be less a case of fear of change and more a case of seeing beautiful structures replaced by ones of much lower quality. And I think that degradation is something we all have to take very seriously as environmental stewards of both the natural and the built environment. And of course, those have to go hand in hand. And by the way, I want to say I regard my friends at Thousand Friends of Oregon as allies on most issues. Like them, I believe that accommodating new residents and managing affordability does not require us to make bad decisions outside of our urban growth boundaries, decisions that would compromise our natural heritage. That's a false choice, and Oregon's land use legacy shows that if we work carefully, much better choices are available to us. But just so, may I say that accommodating new residents and managing affordability does not require us to make bad decisions inside our urban growth boundaries either, decisions that could cause irreparable harm to some of Oregon's most vital urban environmental assets. I would have to conclude on the evidence that in its present form, this bill still poses that grave danger. Thank you.
Thank you very much. No clapping, please. You can go like this to show your support. I do want to just address the process concern, Peggy, that you raised. It's my belief as the chair of this committee that there was no intent to try to ram something through. We, on August 18th, had a huge list of bills, everyone here knows it, that were not at all mature and needed to go on to several more committees before possibly passing out of this legislative body. And to mention a few, the Commission on the Blind, we had basically didn't even have an amendment because we were still working on so many amendments. That finally passed off the floor yesterday, but it took a lot of work. And we needed to, there's no fiscal on it, we needed to send it to the Rules Committee to continue doing work on that. We had the long-term care referral agents, we had the long-term care Purple Ribbon Commission, we had a number of different bills that just because of a tight timeline and because of the gravity of the issues needed more work and needed to go on to the next committee. So I don't believe, I think the amendment had come up because that's as fast as people around the table could get it up. I think everyone on this committee noted that as we were trying to pass things quickly to allow things to have to live because they die on April 18th, if they don't pass out of their first chamber committee. And it's really, there are a lot of really important concepts here. There's a lot of, we've gotten a lot of letters with the concerns that you presented here. We've also had a lot of letters from people that support some of the specific things in the historic designation, and we're trying to hear all. But we, it was not, certainly not a time where we would want to kill a bill that was really trying to get at one of the primary things of building more units. But we knew that there was a lot more work to be done, and that is the reason that we're having this hearing in between before it even gets to Ways and Means, is so that the policy committee can hear more about it. And I'm just sorry about the protocol, never having done this before, taking a bill that left my committee and bringing it back for a public hearing or for an informational hearing. We can't have a public hearing on a bill that's not on our, it, we can only have an informational hearing. And thus we can put the materials presented here on, not even onto the bill's website, but onto our committee's website. So that is just protocol that I'm actually learning in the last few days as I'm trying to give this more of an airing of all of the concerns. So things often feel like they move fast here, and we're doing everything we can to shine the light on it and include different opinions. And again, for anyone that may have missed the beginning, I want to say that if you are interested in presenting any kind of testimony that would go permanently on the record, so go to olis.ledge.state.or.us, click on committees, then click on House, then click on House Human Services and Housing Committee, and then there's an and you can get to today's materials. But if you want to follow 2007 so that you get automatic alerts the minute something's posted, you go to OLIS again, and then you go to Bills, and then you put in 2007, and then there's something at the top that says e-subscribe, put your name. That way, the minute it gets posted, there has to be at least 48 hours. Initially, it has to be 72, but after a bill's being heard, at least 48 hours for it to be heard. So we're doing the best we can with the process with a lot of different bills.
Will there be an engrossed it's really hard to track some of these amendments and tuck, you know, really know what you're reading. Is there going to be a new...
So right now, until a bill is heard in the committee where it sits, which is Ways and Means, all of the amendment that you see that's online under our committee hearing today is just sharing an amendment that is a draft. It's not been adopted. Nothing is engrossed until it leaves its committee. It's adopted and then leaves the committee to the next committee. That's the point at which it's engrossed. I agree, they're really hard to read. When you have an amendment, you have the original, and I'm always scratching on it. But no action can happen on this bill. Nothing can be adopted until there is a public hearing in the committee where it currently resides with 48-hour notice so that people can put their comments on OLIS. And again, that doesn't prevent you from writing to any legislator you want on this committee, Ways and Means, other legislators. But that's just the formality of the protocol. So,
thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much to this panel. Again, if you can sit around in case there's time for questions at the end. And I want to call up the next panel, which is Rob Halliburton, Mary Kyle McCurdy, and Eric King. This is kind of a state view, a city government view, and a nonprofit view on some of the land use issues that this bill addresses.
Should I go first? Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Rob Halliburton. I'm Community Services Division Manager with the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I was asked to come speak to you to provide a broad overview of the statewide land use planning program and in the context of housing and the context of HB 2007. So I will do that fairly high level. I was hoping to leave lots of time for questions and talk more about the structure and the policy and not dive down into the weeds too much, but be able to do that if you have any questions. So I did want to talk about the statewide land use planning program, which is 44 years old this week, and talk about the players in that. The Department of Land Conservation and Development that I work for, of course, reports to the Land Conservation and Development Commission, LCDC, that you've probably heard of. And we certainly are part of the statewide land use planning program, but other parts include cities and counties, local governments, of course, and other state agencies. And together, it's the administration of the statewide land use planning program and land use planning in Oregon. LCDC's role is to set statewide land use policy through the statewide planning goals, some of which I'll talk about today, just a handful of them I'll talk about, and you might have questions about others, and the rules, of course, that implement the goals. But cities and counties are the ones that actually do this land use planning in Oregon. Every city and county is required to have a comprehensive plan implemented through land use regulations, and the plan is required to be in compliance with the statewide planning goals, but they, of course, also address issues of local concern that the state might not have an interest in, and the goals provide a fair amount of or a lot of latitude for jurisdictions how they implement the policies embodied in the goals. I did want to mention that, one of LCDC's roles also is to approve local comprehensive plans as being in compliance with the statewide planning goals through a process called acknowledgement. But once a plan is acknowledged, then the local jurisdiction is implementing its plan. It's no longer implementing the goals directly. And the local comprehensive plan replaces the goals upon acknowledgement. So as a local jurisdiction is making its local land use decisions, it's implementing its plan and code. And so, for example, the development that you heard about in Corvallis, Corvallis wasn't looking at the statewide planning goals or rules at that point. It was looking at its own plan and code. And in that case, if a neighbor or some other party doesn't like the decision that the city made, that the appeal route for that would be to the Land Use Board of Appeals. My department, our commission, doesn't have, in most cases, any role in local land use decisions. LUBA is, as far as we know, a unique body in the country. It's an administrative body appointed by the governor, and their sole charge is to hear land use appeals. There's the milieu here of state and local interests and roles, and I wanted to give you that overview and then talk a little bit about what it is we're doing in the planning program. And I'd like to start talking about urban growth boundaries because it's a key tool that we use across the state for a variety of purposes, and it helps provide perspective on some of the other issues you might hear about. So every urban area in the state is required to be surrounded by an urban growth boundary. You might have heard about this in testimony on this and other bills earlier on. The reason for urban growth boundaries are multiple. It's a tool used for both protection of rural areas, for continuation of our farm and forest economies, and it's a tool for efficient development inside our urban areas. Through the statewide planning program, we encourage most population and job growth to take place inside urban growth boundaries. The UGB is a tool for promoting sustainable, livable development both inside and outside the boundary. And because of the encouragement for development to go inside urban growth boundaries, you will probably or have heard some pushback for bills that might promote additional residential development outside boundaries. So I also wanted to talk specifically about our housing goal, Goal 10, and what it requires. The focus of Goal 10 is on needed housing. We don't use the word affordable housing very much, but needed housing is defined as the housing that is attainable at each price level and our price point and rent level for everyone in a community. So that, of course, includes affordable housing across the income spectrum. And so what Goal 10 requires is a city, or it would be a city and county, but inside the urban growth boundary is the focus of a couple of studies. One would be a housing needs analysis, usually led by the city inside an urban growth boundary. A city would analyze, again, its demographics, and looking forward usually 20 years, what are the housing needs for the expected citizenry of that community? And so, again, at each price point and rent level. So then a city would then be required to accommodate that. It would translate the housing needs into residential land need based on assumptions regarding housing mix, how much is multifamily and how much is different densities of other types of housing, and translate that into how much land it needs for residential use, again, usually for 20 years. And then it's required to accommodate that through its plan and its zoning, and so that barriers are removed to accommodation of needed housing. And so through its plan designations, a city is required to ensure that it is accommodating enough land for each and every type of housing, and that its zoning code allows it with clear and objective standards. You've heard a little bit about clear and objective standards already today. So the Goal 10 provides this framework for a city to determine its needs and to accommodate its needs. But within that framework, cities have considerable discretion and authority as to how they accommodate those needs. We have not at DLCD typically written rules that have exacting standards for the what a city is required to accommodate in its zoning code. Cities determine these on it for their needs within this framework of Goal 10. I didn't realize all the questions were going to go away at the end, so I made this pretty fast. Maybe you like that. There were a couple other questions goals I wanted to mention. One is Goal 11. It's our public facilities and services goal. It requires cities to plan for their water, sewer, storm water management, and address that in concert with where they expect their residential and commercial and industrial needs to go. Like you have heard with regards to provision of affordable housing, planning for infrastructure doesn't necessarily mean that the city has the funds to provide the infrastructure to those planned areas, but at least should they secure the funding for it, the Goal 11 does ask cities to plan ahead for where the development is going to go and at particular densities. I wanted to mention Goal 9 just briefly, which is our economic development goal. It, like Goal 10 for housing, is the same structure where a city would determine what its needs are for the planning period and then accommodate those needs through planning and zoning. It's harder to quantify employment needs than it is housing needs, and so there's a lot more discretion on the part of the local jurisdictions in that regard for Goal 9, but I did want to mention that these are competing uses for urban land, or competing maybe isn't the right word, but other uses that cities need to accommodate inside their urban growth boundaries. And finally, I should probably mention Goal 5, which is our, I usually call it our natural resources goal, but it actually includes other resources as well, including historic resources. The Land Conservation and Development Commission in January updated our Goal 5 rule with regards to protection of historic resources. That was after several meetings of a rulemaking advisory committee, a couple of which members you heard from in the previous panel. We did hear a lot on that panel that their job would have been easier but for historic districts in Portland, and that we did have a lot of focus on those particular issues. The commission did amend the rule in such a way that was largely supported by the heritage community and at least tolerated, we thought, at the time by the development community. And it helped break the link that some cities had made between National Register designation and automatic protection of the resource. It didn't completely break that link. There was still some required review for demolitions, but everything else could not, design review basically, couldn't be an automatic application upon National Register designation. So those have only been in effect for a few months. We haven't gotten any reports back on how that's getting implemented by local jurisdictions, but we certainly can go back into those rules if directed by the legislature.
Okay. Thank you for that overview. Who's next?
Who's next on your agenda?
City. I was thinking state, yeah. City, nonprofit. Okay. Makes sense.
Okay.
How does the city apply?
Yes. My name is Eric King. I'm the city manager of Bend. Prior to that, I spent 10 years working for the city of Portland and working in the Office of Neighborhood Involvement. So I understand kind of both sides of the equation here. And, you know, for Bend, I'm going to use a ski analogy to kind of describe our affordable housing program or our affordable housing problem. Really, it's the housing prices are much like the backdrop of the Cascades, very peak, sharp, beautiful valleys, majestic mountains. The income, the wages in Bend are much like a Nordic skiing, pretty flat, right? So our median family house, the price of a house in Bend was $176,000 during the recession. It has climbed to $400,000 now. Our area median income is around $60,000 for a family of four. It's a major crisis for the city of Bend to be providing affordable housing for our residents. We have about 5,000 units that are needed going back to the state's housing needs analysis. We just completed that as we embarked on a UGB expansion. And that analysis shows that really those folks making less than 60% of area median income are the greatest and greatest need. So the city's been really creative at how do we address this problem. We just didn't look at it from a regulatory perspective. We didn't look at it just from, how do we incentivize? We also have the good fortune of having an affordable housing program that's a fund that is a basically an excise tax. It's a 1/3 of 1% that gets tacked on to a building permit fee, and that provides $1 to $2 million in revenue per year. Since its inception in 2006, we've built over 700 units, and what's more important is that those units have been able to leverage over $70 million of state and federal funding, and then another $13 million of private equity to get more units constructed. So we've been talking a lot about kind of the land use system, but I think it's important to note that for local communities to make some progress with affordable housing, they have to look really in all corners, and funding is a big need. I think we can't just look to the state or federal government to solve that problem, and Ben has a good example of doing that. Removing kind of regulatory barriers, including system development charges. So we have exempted SDCs for affordable housing projects. We've also really taken a look at our process. So we have expedited review for affordable housing. We guarantee within 2 weeks of submittal, response back from the city. This is, again, time is money. We've heard that as part of the presentation. So we can't just rely on the land use system to fix this issue. We've got to look at all dimensions. In terms of the changes that we've made within the land use context, and some of this has happened as, again, part of the urban growth boundary expansion, is looking at different housing types. So accessory dwelling units, there's been a lot of discussion around that. We have made accessory dwelling units outright permitted use in our residential zones. So we've reduced the cost and the process that you need to go through. That came with some conflict. So we have an affordable housing committee that has been pushing policy packages. We also have a planning commission, neighborhood association, and they've been pushing back the other side. And what happened was a compromise of, for example, parking, looking at how we deal with on-street or on-site parking versus parking that happens in the right-of-way. And so those issues get worked out at the local level, and I think we've got good examples of that. We've also done things like density bonuses for affordable housing, height bonuses for multifamily housing when affordable housing units are included. And then with the UGB expansion, we've have higher maximum densities in the residential zones. We've removed lot size barriers and reduced parking standards for residential uses in mixed-use zones. So, for us, it's really you know, no stone left unturned. And I would make a plug, too, that for us, the major barrier in getting more affordable housing is really infrastructure funding, that getting new roads built, having the public agency participate in the process. If we're going to address this problem, we can't just sort of expect the development community to build this. We have to be partners. And I think that's what you're all trying to do here is demonstrate partnership. But it's nuanced. You have to work with your community and work with all sides of it to be able to thread the needle. So I just would close and say that House Bill 2007, I think, is very workable for the city of Bend. It's something that we're interested in and want to be a partner with you in helping solve some of these problems. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Mary Kyle McCurdy, Deputy Director at 1000 Friends of Oregon. 1000 Friends of Oregon supports housing that meets the needs of all Oregonians while protecting our resource lands from sprawl. That means we promote diverse housing in all communities where people have access to work, school, health care, public amenities, and transit. And that's what Oregon's Land Use Planning Program, Goal 10, calls for, too. Goal 10's the housing goal says, plans shall encourage the availability of adequate numbers of needed housing units at price ranges and rent levels, which are commensurate with the financial capabilities of Oregon households, and allow for flexibility of housing location, type, and density. Those words were written in the late 1970s and are yet as reflective today of the values of Oregonians as they were back then. We want all our neighborhoods, towns, and cities to be welcoming places of opportunity for all Oregonians, and that includes diverse housing types located in areas of opportunity. Yet, we have fallen short on this goal, and that's why 1000 Friends of Oregon supports House Bill 2007. This bill takes important steps to better ensure our towns and cities are providing for the housing needs of all in every neighborhood. We support the bill's objectives to ensure that every city provides clear and objective standards for all residential development on land zoned for residential use, to provide more opportunities for missing middle housing types of accessory units and duplexes, and ensures that decisions made about historic districts are made locally through by publicly elected bodies through transparent processes and not through the current workaround of the National Historic District designation, which is not a public process made by local public bodies, publicly elected bodies. Today, there's almost no city in Oregon in which a family making the median income can afford the median priced home for rent or purchase based on paying 30% of one's income on housing. That inability to find affordable, well-located housing is impacting middle and lower income Oregonians. We often hear the term housing crisis to describe the situation we're in, and I bristle at that term because I think it implies that this situation happened quickly and we'll just find that one magic tool and we'll have it solved. Neither of those is true. There are many reasons for the situation that we find ourselves in, many of which have nothing to do with land use. But land use does have a role to play in both the problem and the solutions. Oregon cities are experiencing a long-standing structural mismatch between the amount, type, location, and affordability of housing that Oregonians need, and how our cities and towns have zoned their residential lands for decades. The structural mismatch has been exacerbated by the population increases in many of our communities. Our residential zoning has simply not kept up with the changing demographics and needs of middle and lower income Oregon families, and we will continue to fall farther behind without action. As you heard the gentleman from Central City concerned, we're 100,000 units short at all price levels in Oregon, and that is growing. Every community, how did we get here? You've heard a little bit of this already. Every community in Oregon, and this is nationally, has a similar profile in which two-thirds of all households are one to two people in size. This is a long-term trend, and the percentage is growing. These are young couples who have not yet started a family, an older couple whose children are grown, the 20-something just starting out, the 70-something widow, the single parent with one or two children. There are nurses, teachers, electricians, medical technicians, the person who waited on you somewhere today. They want to live in walkable neighborhoods with good schools, age in their neighborhood that they raise their children in, and live near the places they work. Yet the vast majority of residential land in all of our communities is zoned for single-family detached housing on lots of 5,000 square feet or more. In Portland, 90% of all the residential land is zoned for detached single-family housing. In Medford, it's 67%. That's a pretty typical range. It has been that way since the 1950s. We've zoned most of our residential lands in ways that functionally exclude a large percentage of Oregonians at any price with housing types that just don't fit their housing family sizes, and certainly economically exclude many of them. This is not an outcome that reflects Oregon values or Goal 10 for that matter, and it's time, I think, to rethink just what we mean by a single family neighborhood. Today's families come in all shapes and sizes and income levels, and all should have the opportunity to live in all neighborhoods. Whether it's the widow who wants to stay in her own neighborhood after the kids are grown, and so an attached cottage cluster makes sense, or the intergenerational family for whom a duplex or a triplex is perfect, or the returning college student who lives in their parents' ADU. But these options are prohibited in many of our single-family neighborhoods. We should be focusing on the form of the housing and structures and not so much on the number of units inside it, which you saw illustrated earlier by Eli Spivak's slideshow. Our towns and cities find themselves in this structural mismatch and affordable housing needs for many reasons. Some of it is simple neglect. Some of those land use plans that Rob described have not been updated for residential zoning since the 1980s. And some of it is through actions. The primary means of building wealth in the United States is through home ownership. And yet, as we all know, historically, many of our single-family neighborhoods that exist today were not open to non-white people. And so that path to owning a home in every neighborhood was not available to all. And we see the impacts of that remaining today. Today, Oregonians in towns and cities across the state are experiencing other housing barriers of not clear and objective standards, vague design criteria. Design criteria do not have to be vague, and I do believe design's criteria is important, but it doesn't have to be vague. And they're experiencing limits on diverse housing types, infill development, redevelopment, and development on smaller lots through outright prohibition, and the misuse of a National Historic District designation to prevent change. This has resulted in insufficient housing supply, lack of needed diversity in housing, and more expensive housing in more economically segregated neighborhoods. There are certainly reasonable regulations on housing to protect trees, natural resources, and to ensure that the scale of housing is appropriate, getting back to form and scale. But as many studies have documented, local zoning restrictions that leave intact the historical notion of what a single-family neighborhood is by zoning out the missing middle housing types and preventing diverse housing through infill and redevelopment are having a detrimental impact on housing affordability for middle and lower income families citywide, statewide, in all our towns. And the result of this, by keeping these housing types out of many of our neighborhoods, is resulting in displacement and gentrification of lower income neighborhoods as certain neighborhoods become off limits financially and exclude housing types that most Oregonians need at some point in their lives. In contrast, providing robust opportunities in all of our neighborhoods for more diverse missing middle housing types, including ADUs, duplexes, infill, and redevelopment, will result in both more and more affordable housing. But if most of our cities, neighborhoods are walled off to anything except detached single-family homes on larger lots, we will continue our march towards ever greater unaffordability and exclusion of many from ever owning a home. I'm going to quote just a few studies and then end. Quote, when new housing development is precluded in neighborhoods with political capital to implement even stricter local barriers, the new housing that does get built tends to be disproportionately concentrated in low-income communities of color, causing displacement and concerns of gentrification in those neighborhoods. Rising rents region-wide can exacerbate that displacement. A large and growing body of empirical research has now demonstrated that restrictions on housing diversity and density cause unexpected, unintended harms. They radically inflate housing costs, segregate neighborhoods by class, displace longstanding residents by pricing them out of their rented homes, and amplify economic disparities between rich and poor, eliminate opportunities for working people to improve their lots in life, and trap children in poverty. And in the new exclusionary zoning, an exhaustive academic review of urban exclusionary zoning published in 2014 in the Stanford Law Review, the advent of historic preservation in the 1960s is also part of this trend. Historic preservation districts effectively remove parts of the city from the stock of developable land and impose additional approvals for development within them. This makes development more expensive or prevents it outright, both of which raise housing prices in high-demand areas. The solution to meeting the housing needs of all Oregon families is not to push them to the edge or out of a city, or to exclude them from certain neighborhoods, or to offer them just an apartment on the eighth floor of a building. We can do better. I'm going to quote in ending from AARP, a strong supporter of opening up all single-family neighborhoods to missing middle housing types, who stated, "We are all born. We all need certain things as a small child, teenager, young adult, young family, empty nester, person living alone, and older adult. So let's plan for everyone along that life cycle." House Bill 2007 provides a great start to fulfilling the Oregon values reflected in Goal 10 by opening up opportunities in all neighborhoods for all families. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we thank you very much. We have we have a speaker here who can make a few a few closing remarks, and we will see if there's any burning questions for anyone that's been on the panel before we adjourn. We also are going to do a very quick work session on Senate Bill 58. Thank you so much, Mike.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Rep, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the Oregon House. I'll try to be brief. My comments are online. I want to thank you, first of all, for having an informational hearing on House Bill 2007. Certainly, as bills get introduced and move quickly, sometimes I think it takes a while sometimes for everybody else to know what's going on down here. And we've heard a lot about this bill, and I want to thank everyone who's here today. I'm sorry I couldn't be here for the whole hearing, but I think you got a lot of perspective on this bill, which I think is really important. I think you've heard me talk several times in this committee about the crisis our state is facing and how it'll take several years to put us back on a better track of providing enough housing. It's not just about tenant protections. It's not just about preserving. It's also about the supply of new housing, both affordable and market rate. And 2007 is an attempt to be in line with our land use goals here in the state and try to get more housing into the market and more affordable housing as well. And I know the Dash 4s have been reviewed, so I'm not going to do that, although there's more information in my testimony. We all know we have a serious problem. It's also very destabilizing, particularly for low-income communities and for communities of color. One of the most common barriers to affordable housing development is what we hear as the not in my backyard issue, the NIMBY response from some folks. Unfortunately, much of the opposition that we're hearing about this bill is also, I believe, grounded in NIMBYism. I've heard concerns about preserving neighborhood character or neighborhood control of development approval. But underlying some of these arguments is a desire to make sure that certain neighborhoods, often higher income neighborhoods, are treated differently than others. Certain neighborhoods, some argue, should be off limits, even though we're facing a housing crisis. And that's just not that's unacceptable, colleagues. We don't have the luxury of doing business as usual here in the state, and we need to change. House Bill 2007 would get rid of some of the loopholes that allow NIMBYism to block development when wealthy neighborhoods simply want to self-segregate and prevent affordable housing development in their communities. I want to specifically address the change in the Dash 4 to the automatic protections granted by the National Historic Designation process, which has become one of the more controversial elements of the bill. First, I think it's really important that we all acknowledge that historic districts can create barriers to building housing. I think you've heard some of that today. Some opponents of the bill have argued that historic districts should not be considered, quote unquote, a supply issue. But the reality is that any land use regulations that create barriers to infill development or more dense development are a supply issue. Second, I think we have to acknowledge that land use regulations at the local level have history, they are political, and they should be scrutinized to ensure that they do not perpetuate the racialized inequities that have been built into them. As a 2016 article in The Atlantic stated, when local and state government bodies grant preservation status to historic districts, sometimes entire neighborhoods, they do not always simply protect culture, architecture, and history. Sometimes they also shore up wealth, status, and power. Historic preservation is a tool better used to safeguard the historical resources in which everyone can take pride, not the historical resources that were only ever allotted to winners by race-based housing policies. Furthermore, the research tells us that strict land use regulation at the local level drives urban income segregation. Research also tells us that income segregation is reduced when there is a higher level of involvement from state institutions in the planning process. That said, we have heard from neighborhood groups that have been concerned that single-family homes are being demolished and replaced with more expensive single-family homes. And I want to be really clear, that's happening in my neighborhood as well. That's happening all across Portland and certain other areas of metro area. Groups have been concerned that removing the automatic protection for historic districts would encourage that trend, which of course is counter to the intent of the bill. So to address those concerns, as been noted, the Dash 4 Amendment maintains the automatic application of demolition review when single-family homes are being replaced with new single-family homes. But the bill removes it if, A, the house is being replaced with more dense development, B, the house is being replaced with a home affordable to a household making less than 125% of median family income. C, when the demolition is of an accessory structure, for example, a garage. And D, the demolition is an aesthetic change to the home because an aesthetic change is not a demolition. So this bill also reiterates that local jurisdictions may add protections to historic districts, including those that are exempted from the automatic application. They just do so through a local decision-making process. We are facing a housing shortage with dire circumstances, and frankly, I'm disappointed that this bill has run into some of the same old NIMBYism that helped create this crisis by slowing development as our population skyrockets. And I don't think we have to be reminded that we just finished a winter where a lot of people didn't have a place to live. I know the folks in this room have concerns about this bill, and they have been very vocal about it, and I very much appreciate their advocacy. We can only do legislation here when we hear and get feedback on what we're doing. We have everything we do here has consequences and implications. I think you see in the Dash 4 an attempt to address some of those concerns. And I would encourage folks who have sat here today and who will end up listening in and hearing about this hearing to look at the Dash 4s and think it through and help us be part of the solution to the crisis facing our state. State has to take a more direct role in living up the standards of clear and objective standards in Goal 10. And that's what this bill does. And I hope we get it done. And I hope everyone can work together to make sure that every Oregonian has a place to live that's affordable and accessible and has quality standards. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Starr.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Garrett. Madam Speaker, I just wanted to take a moment and thank you for your hard work on this bill. One of the things I've really appreciated about this bill, and isn't always the case with when we have amendments flying at us so far or so fast in this building, is that I've really appreciated your office's willingness and ability to go above and beyond and circulate concepts and talk through concepts before ever putting it into amendment form. Appreciate the work on the Dash 4. So I just really have been in awe with this bill, despite that some people felt like it came and went really quick. My experience with what your office has done with this bill in this building has been very open and very open to dialogue and worked really hard to make sure people had a voice into that process. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stark, thank you. And I also want to thank our housing staffer in my office, Taylor Smiley Wolf. She's been doing all of the work to make sure we understand the concerns and try to address them. So I want to thank her publicly. Thank you.
Are there any burning questions?
One thing, Madam Chair, I don't see Dash 4s in OLIS.
Oh, yeah. So I'm sorry, because you were at the legislative breakfast and you were late, but it's on the committee agenda for today.
Okay.
Because it's unusual in that we're having an informational hearing on a bill that's not in our committee.
Okay.
So it's not, so you'll see the Dash 4 as well as the summary, as well as whatever testimony was presented by people that were on the panel today.
And Madam Chair, if I may, it's a really good point. And I really do, again, appreciate the informational. I think when bills get to Ways and Means, they sit for quite a while, and they won't have as much vetting there. At this point, our intention is the bill would be amended with the Dash 4. When we're able to move it, it will have some fiscal attached to it to do some of this work. And our goal is to get it moved and funded with the Dash 4s.
Okay, so if you have questions for anyone on the panel, Cassie's got telephone numbers. I'm sorry that we're running out of time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to close the informational hearing on House Bill 2007, and I'm going to quickly open a work session on Senate Bill 58D. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Can I have a motion?
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move to adopt the
B5, amendments dated 5-22-17.
Good. Vice Chair Sanchez moves to adopt the B5 amendments dated 5-22-17. Is there any discussion?
Section there, too. Thanks.
Okay.
Quickly, these are conflict amendments, so they just make it simple.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right. Any objection? No. Seeing none, amendments are adopted.
Chair Kenny Gare, I move Senate Bill 58B as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Vice Chair Sanchez moves Senate Bill 58B as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Dorsey.
Yes.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Nierman.
Aye.
Representative Noble.
Aye.
Representative Russo.
Aye.
Representative Stark.
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson.
Excused.
Vice Chair Sanchez.
Aye.
Aye. The motion passes. Would anyone like to carry this bill?
I will.
Great. Representative Gorsuch, thank you. With that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 58 and the meeting is adjourned. And the meeting is adjourned. 58.